Working group will come to order. I'd like to just start by congratulating the staff and a couple of us for being here after a very long night last night. We're trying not to miss a beat, though. So, and we do have a number of presentations to make today to help us move along with the discussion of affordability for individuals. And we're going to start with that presentation of materials with Katie Kavanagh, Senate Counsel and Research.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you received a big packet, more information than you probably want. And what we're trying to attempt to do and to gather is information from Massachusetts, Minnesota, and Vermont to try to attempt to look at the products that are in these states, what the cost of these products are. And if you can see, we do have a chart here that takes various scenarios, the ages of the individuals and their income, and we look at Massachusetts, Minnesota, and Vermont, and we try to attempt to look at what that individual would be able to purchase a health plan. And in looking at that, I think we also have to maybe revisit for Massachusetts and Vermont what we're comparing here, what is actually offered in these states, and in looking again at Massachusetts, and I know that this has been talked about in this group already, but I think it might help in our discussions on affordability is to re-examine the affordability standard that Massachusetts has set. And the affordability standard establishes the percentage of the individual's gross income that individual can be expected to contribute toward the cost of health insurance that meets the minimum creditable coverage standards. And these standards have been established by the Board of Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector Authority to determine whether Massachusetts residents would be required to purchase affordable, credible health insurance. And this affordability schedule and the premium schedule is to be established by the board annually. And the intent is to reconfigure these schedules to factor in premium trends and the changes in the federal poverty guidelines. And in determining these schedules, the board has taken into account the cost of deductibles as well as the capping of deductibles. And a copy of the Massachusetts affordability and premium schedule is in your packet. And with this, if you take a look at it, it shows the schedule for individuals, married couples without dependents, and families. And it looks at the gross income, what the affordable monthly premium is set at, and that percentage of income that premium makes up.
What is the title on the schedule you're looking at?
It is Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector Authority. And in that is the that's the affordability schedule and the premium schedule. And the premium schedule establishes the lowest level of premium that are deemed by the board to be available within these geographic locations for minimum creditable coverage. And I think it's important to note that these affordability standards are basically to determine whether this penalty is going to be incurred or not. And under these standards, anybody eligible for Commonwealth care, so that's with income at or below 300%, will be deemed able to afford creditable health care. And if you are an individual with income of $15,315 or below, or a married couple without children with income $20,350 below, or a family with an annual income of $25,755 or below, or if you look at the affordability schedule, those that would have be deemed to have zero premium, then if and you would be eligible for Commonwealth care, except for some reason your income would make you eligible for Commonwealth care, but for some reason you fall within some category that makes you ineligible, then you would not be subject to a penalty. And then in Massachusetts, all other persons shall be deemed able to afford creditable health insurance if they were eligible to purchase it through their employer for an amount that does not exceed the amount set for the monthly premiums on the affordability schedule. And if they did not have creditable health insurance available, so if they don't have insurance available through their employer, they are deemed able to afford creditable insurance if the amount set for the monthly premium in the affordability schedule is equal to or greater than the amount set for their age, family size, and geographic location in the premium schedule. So the premium schedule and the affordability schedule is basically, they work in concert with each other to determine whether this penalty is going to be incurred. And again, we also need to keep in mind the minimum creditable coverage that Massachusetts has set. And these standards begin January 1, 2009. And that includes preventive and primary care, emergency care, hospitalization, ambulatory patient care, mental health services, prescription drugs, rehabilitative care, vision care. And there can be three levels of plans offered that vary by price and cost sharing. Bronze, silver, and gold is what Massachusetts calls it. The plans may impose reasonable exclusions and limitations, including different benefit levels and in-network and out-of-network providers. The deductible is capped at $2,000 for individuals and $4,000 for families. And the plan may impose a deductible for inpatient benefits, or if the plan does impose a deductible, the plan must cover, before imposing a deductible, for an individual at least 3 preventive care visits, and for a family at least a total of 6 preventive care visits. There's also a prescription drug deductible. That's capped at $250 an individual and $500 a family. And then there is an alternative coverage option that's available that can be provided. The out-of-pocket maximum is set at $5,000 for individuals, and for families, it's $10,000. And the out-of-pocket costs that are included to make up this maximum are co-payments over $100, all co-insurance, and all deductibles. Does not include the amount paid for prescription drugs, however. And these plans are offered through the connector, and there are 6 health plans that are offering products. And what I did is took some of these scenarios and went into the connector, and that's also in your packet. And so you can tell what is available for that scenario.
And which paper is that on?
It's attached, I think it was under Commonwealth. It's the Commonwealth connector, and there is an individual. No, it's, there's, keep going. These are the scenarios. Individual, age 57, it's a professional. There are 22 plans that are available with various deductibles, co-payments, co-insurance. Give you an indication of what is available in Massachusetts for at least several of the scenarios. And also in your packet is the premium schedule for the Commonwealth Care Program. persons with income under 300%. Then I think in looking at turning to Vermont, Vermont has the Vermont Health Plan, which is an insurance program for adults only. And the cost of the program depends on the individual's income. And the benefits under this plan are doctor's visits, prescriptions, emergency room care, inpatient hospital care, outpatient care, tests and x-rays, family planning, mental health services, substance abuse services, home health care, medical supplies, and equipment and vision care. The cost sharing is 50% coverage. So the co-payment is 50% for the cost of prescriptions. Eligibility for this program, an individual over the age of 18 has to have an income under 150%, or parents with income under 185%. And as part of their health care reform, effective July 1st of 07, the premiums for this plan were reduced by 35%. The premiums now range from $7 to $49. And the next plan that's available is the Catamount plan. This is an insurance program that's administered through the private market. To be eligible, you have to be uninsured with no coverage offered through your employer. And then Vermont defines what uninsured means, and that your insurance coverage, if you do have insurance coverage, that you'd be considered uninsured if it only covers hospital care or doctor visits. And you must not have had private insurance for the past 12 months. And there are some exceptions to that. Benefits to this program: primary care, preventive care, acute care, hospital services, chronic care, management, prescription drugs. And this does have some cost-sharing requirements with deductibles of inpatient $250 for an individual, $500 for a family. Out-of-network is $500 for an individual, $1,000 for a family, 20% co-insurance. There's co-payments of $10 for the office visits, prescription drug coverage. There is no deductible, but there is a co-payment of $10 for generic drugs, $30 for preferred drug lists, and $50 for non-preferred drugs. And then an out-of-pocket max of $800 individual, $1,600 family for inpatient and in-network, and out-network is $1,500 for individual, $3,000 for family. Preventive care is not subject to any of the deductible co-insurance or co-payments. And chronic care isn't subject to cost sharing either if the person enrolls in a chronic care management program. And the premiums for full cost of the Catamount Health, that has been just recently determined at $390. If your income is less than 300%, then there is premium assistance for Catamount care coverage. And then Vermont also has just recently put together their employer-sponsored insurance premium assistance program, and this goes into effect October 1st, 2007. to be eligible, the individual must have individuals with income under 150% and parents under 185% who are eligible for the Vermont health plan. And who have access to a employer-subsidized plan would be eligible. Individuals with income between 150% and 300% who have access to employer plan. And individuals with income between 150% and 300% without access to an employer plan, but who wish to enroll in Catamount Health, would then get the premium assistance for the Catamount Health through this program.
And to be eligible for premium assistance for an employer-subsidized plan, the individual must have not or must have been uninsured for at least 12 months unless there are these there are certain exceptions to that. And an individual enrolled in or eligible for the Vermont Health for the premium assistance program would be required to purchase the employer-sponsored coverage. If the coverage is as good as the typical plan for the four largest insurers in the small group market, and the state determines that it's cost-effective. So these are individuals that are 150% poverty, or parents that are 185% or poverty. And individuals who would otherwise be eligible for Catamount Health, so up to 300%, would get assistance purchasing their employer-sponsored coverage if they have that available, if the employer's plan is equivalent to the Catamount Health and the state determines that the employer-sponsored insurance is more cost-effective than enrolling that person into Catamount Health. And the premium assistance to purchase employer-subsidized insurance runs from is basically the premium for Catamount Health and Vermont Health Plan. So it runs from $7 to $135. And there is a wraparound service that is provided for those that are eligible for the Vermont Health Plan. So if you're in the lower income, 150% for individual, 185% for family, then the state would then cover the any deductibles that your employer plan has, and it would cover services that the Vermont Health Plan would cover, but your employer plan does not cover. And there is also then a chronic care wraparound for those at the higher, you know, that are eligible for Catamount Health, so with income under 300%, the state would then pay for any cost sharing associated with the employer plan for treatment of the chronic care conditions. And this plan, or this program, also states that enrollment in the assistance program will be suspended if there's not enough money to support the premium assistance. And the individuals would then either remain eligible for Vermont Health Plan or Catamount. And Vermont also does have the Dr. Dinosaur program for their children. This program covers pregnant women and children up to the age of 18 and provides a full range of health care services. And for children, the eligibility guideline goes up to 300%, and for pregnant women, it's 200%, and there's no asset limit for the program. And the premiums for this program, as part of the health care reform, the premiums were cut by 50% effective July 1 of 2007, and the premiums now range from 185% to 225%. It's $15 per household. It's $15 per month per household. From 225% to 300%, it is $20 per month per household if the family has other insurance that includes hospital and physician care, or $40 per month per household if the family has other insurance. So that's that.
Maybe we should stop here and just see if there are questions, either about Massachusetts or Vermont.
Senator Berglund?
Yes.
My question would be, what was the hospital coverage on the two different plans? You were talking about the inpatient hospital piece. How does it compare to Minnesota, I guess, is my question. I don't know the answer to that.
I think it's comparable.
So it's $10,000 for inpatient?
Oh, not, oh, no, no, no.
Tell me, what, okay.
There is no limit.
Okay, that's...
So when you're saying Minnesota, you mean MinnesotaCare.
MinnesotaCare is $10,000, so they have no limit?
There is
both
no
states
limit.
Are that way?
Yep.
Wow.
But they have much higher deductibles.
Correct.
For the outpatient care. Other questions? I can tell you that in Vermont, they do not have a mandate to have insurance, but they are trying with the effort, with the reforms that they have passed, to reduce their 14%+ of uninsured to 10%. And in Massachusetts, while they do have a mandate that everyone have coverage, they have this exception if the only coverage available to you is more than what they've deemed as affordable. And so they are expecting about 5% of the people to not end up having coverage due to that exception. It does appear to me, based on what I've seen of the materials that the staff's pulled together from Massachusetts, that the people that will tend to fall in that category will tend to be older people, the people 50 to 65. Now, maybe some of them will, you know, decide to have coverage anyway, even though it's not deemed affordable because they worry about their health at that age. But it is an age group that seems to me one needs to worry about if you want to be avoiding uncompensated care. Any other questions so far? Okay, let's keep going then.
Well, and I think we also then provided you with MCHA's premium rates.
Now, just so everybody knows what MCHA means in Minnesota, this is where you can go to get your insurance if you are being denied coverage on an individual basis by insurance companies in the state because of your health condition. And I might add, in my opinion, it doesn't take very much of a health condition to become an MCHA candidate.
And then what we also did for Minnesota.
And again, I think, you know, just so people take the time to look at this, what you can see is that for the higher the age group of people that would be MCHA candidates, of course, the higher the premiums are, the less affordable the premiums are.
Okay, and we also did was take the same scenarios that we were running for the this table and plugged it in for Minnesota to see what was available for the individual market.
And again, that would be those who are considered insurable in the individual market.
And I think you can get a flavor of what's available for these various scenarios. And hopefully that then will give you a better indication. And I think with this table, what we tried to do was, for example, the Minnesota premiums, we looked at, you know, we took $2,000 deductible, for example, with because that's the Massachusetts minimal creditable standard, and then we tried to compare those. The MCHA was, we used the 2,000 deductible premium and tried to compare that as best we could with the in the private market for Minnesota.
And again, however, these are not exactly apples to apples because in Massachusetts, even with a $2,000 deductible, you would have a certain number of preventative visits that the deductible did not apply toward, and you would have a different deductible on your prescription drugs. So not really possible because of product design to do apples to apples, but this was the best we could, closest we could come up with.
I just have a clarifying question on the MSHA table. The one, two, three, the fourth column over where all it says is it's a high deductible health plan. Do you know, like, what are they, like, what's a high deductible? I mean, because one could look at those and think they're all kind of high deductible plans, so I'm just kind of confused what that one is.
Well, it looks at down here. It's a 2007 calendar year deductible amount.
What does it say right there, right for me? Oh, I'm sorry.
50 individual, 56, 50
Thank you.
For a family.
Thanks.
Are there any questions on the MSHA table? Okay.
That's it.
Then why don't we move on to the next presentation, which we thought would be important for question? Mr. Godfrey, I'm sorry.
Senator Berglund, work group members, I'm just going to go over a couple of handouts that are in your packet. Some might have been just handed out. Some others might be in your folder, but I'll just point out what they are. The first one I'll go over is a legal size, one-page handout entitled Premium Scenario for Expanding Minnesota Care to 300% of Poverty. And what this handout shows is just the scenario from an affordability standpoint of expanding Minnesota care to 300% of poverty and applying basically the current premium structure to that expansion and adding.
Excuse me, let's just stop a minute. One side says Vermont Access Plan. The other side, making efficient use of paper, has the premium scenario. Everybody got it? Okay.
That's correct.
All right, David, continue.
And so this is the premium scenario side of the handout, and what it shows is if you expanded Minnesota care to 300%, we use the current premium structure, which runs from 1.8% of percent of income to 8.8% of income, then adding an additional tier for the expanded group that's at 9.6% of income. And so just looking, say, at a household size of one, you can see the income level, or the monthly gross income, where that puts them in terms of the poverty level, what the premium amount is, and then what percent of income that premium amount is relative to the monthly gross income. Also on this, for each household size, is listed the full cost of the Minnesota premium under current law, which is 350% of poverty. And that might be useful in the event that the legislature, say, chose to allow people to buy in to Minnesota care at the full cost premium above 300%, for instance, as Vermont allows people to do. There's one big caveat to that, however, which is that the full cost premium currently at $350 a month is based on current law. And if you were to expand eligibility to Minnesota care and we had the new enrollees would come in, the full cost premium would have to be recalculated based on the costs that those folks would incur in Minnesota care. So if your expansion takes place and the population that comes into the program as a result of that is less healthy than the existing population of Minnesota care, you could expect that the full cost premium would increase. And so that's this side of the handout. On the back,
let's just stop here a minute because obviously you can see based on these premiums and comparing them, for example, to the MSHA premiums, if a person otherwise would be eligible for MSHA, But instead, they're coming into MinnesotaCare because it's a lot more affordable for them, and in fact, MSHA might not be affordable at all for them. MinnesotaCare has no underwriting in it. So people come in, and they are accepted based on the fact that they do not have employer insurance offered to them, and they are under a certain income category. And so we believe, and we've always believed, that the Minnesota full cost is higher than it would be, for instance, if you mandated coverage, because then you would have a lot of people that just decide not to take coverage because they feel like maybe they might be healthy enough to get by without it. We know a lot of times they're guessing wrong, but they make that judgment. So if we were either to expand eligibility to MinnesotaCare or allow people to buy in at full cost between 300 and 400% of poverty, for example, as they do in Vermont, without going to a mandated coverage situation, we could experience a lot more adverse selection into that program, which would then drive up the premiums for everyone in the program. So that's just something to keep in mind.
Continue, David.
Senator Bergen?
Ms. Rowe?
I was just wondering, do we have a sense of, in terms of MinnesotaCare, how many people apply, are eligible, look at the premiums, and then don't take the program? And the other question would be, how many people are on the program and then find that they can't afford it and drop? Does anybody track either of those issues?
I don't know if we have that information. We can ask the department if they have it. We do know that when we raised premiums in 2003, and again we raised premiums in 2005, but that never went into effect because the waiver never came through before we changed our mind about it. But we do know that that did have an impact on enrollment. How much that by itself had as an impact, we don't know, because there were other things that were done at the same time that made it harder to enroll. A shorter eligibility time, more paperwork had to be filled out by your employer, just many other barriers that also could have contributed to people not feeling like they wanted to enroll in the program. So, you know, it's hard to know which one thing, but we do have, through the course of the program, testimony and some credible evidence that people are pretty price sensitive in these income categories. And so we do have reason to believe that while the other barriers certainly were a problem for some people, that the premium increase was as well.
Yeah, the reason I was asking was just that even looking at the percent of income, once you start getting up to the, you know, 4.8, 8.8, that when you think of the article that I think Representative Thiessen sent out that sort of was looking at Massachusetts on affordability, those seem to be, for that income level, seem to be kind of high, or at least based on that analysis. So I was just curious whether there was any way to see that really is a problem or not.
We do have information about how many people in each income category are enrolled. We could get you that.
Interesting.
And we have fewer people at the higher income brackets enrolled, which might be partly price, but we think also, you know, to some extent, as you get into the higher income categories, people may be choosing to cover themselves. You can see, based on these materials, if you're young enough, you can get products in the private market that are competitive with these prices. And we think there are fewer uninsured in those categories because they have more access to employer-based coverage available to them. Other questions? Yes.
Senator, just to address that question, the reading materials you sent out that Pete kindly gave us as our assignment, the article, it's The Premium Stupid by Gilmer. In those, and I think he was using data that was back 2003, 2004, in their calculations, the estimate was, I believe, something like 17.9 million Americans at the time were going without health insurance, making the choice based on those premiums. So in addition to the roughly 45 million at that time, there were another 40% who were avoiding it based on the cost. They were eligible, but not making the payment based on cost. I don't know if that helps anyway, estimating what that magnitude might be in Minnesota just based on the size of the uninsured pool.
I might just add that we in the legislature at least, have felt that Minnesota Care is a value. I mean, it's a very comprehensive benefit set. It has very, very low copays, no deductibles, full prescription drug coverage, dental coverage, eyeglasses coverage, mental health coverage, chemical dependency coverage, and it does all of this without any underwriting. So we believe that it is a value, and we have heard from even higher income families when they were threatened about losing their coverage in the governor's budget of how important it was to them to have the Minnesota coverage available, and that they did not believe they could afford coverage if they had to go out in the private market by themselves. So, you know, it's hard to tell when you're getting it right exactly, but we do have some evidence that people do believe that it is a valuable product for them. Other questions?
Senator Berglund, working group members, before we flip over the legal size sheet, I just wanted to mention that this is strictly just an analysis of the affordability of the premium relative to the gross income, but it doesn't really speak to the costs that would be associated with expanding Minnesota Care to 300% of poverty. I do have one small handout in your packet, which looks like this. And it's entitled Minnesota Care Fiscal Analysis of a Proposal to Expand Minnesota Care Families with Children to 300% of Poverty. This is an informal fiscal note from DHS, and it shows the cost on the bottom line of the total state share cost impact of this expansion that's reflected in the premium tables we just looked at being about $4.8 million by fiscal year 11 once it's fully implemented. I think it's interesting to note it shows the anticipated enrollment effect of that expansion, and in terms of numbers, it's relatively a small amount. At least by 11, you're talking about only 693 individuals who would take advantage of the program by fiscal year 11. And the department responded that the reason for that was simply because they expected that the premiums, even with the subsidy that they would receive, would be too high for many people to actually take up the program. In terms of adults without children being expanded to 300% of poverty, currently they're at they will be at 200% next fiscal year. We don't have any fiscal information on that. We'll be getting that, requesting that from the department. Just to note that you could anticipate that cost would be much greater than this families with children expansion, not just because the expansion would be a greater percent of income, but also because that population is generally more expensive, I should say, than families with children. So then, returning to the legal sheet and flipping it over, this is just a quick comparison of the Vermont Health Access Plan and the Catamount Health Assistance Program that Katie discussed to a Minnesota Care program that would be expanded to 300% of poverty, looking at just the affordability piece of it. And you'll see different tiers of poverty levels on the far left side. The monthly gross income is listed for identical amounts for both programs. And what you see is under what's entitled VHAP premium. This is their existing program for adults. The premiums are actually more expensive than the Minnesota Care premiums are for that for those income levels. You also see next to that premium column is VHAP ESI, and this just shows that this is what an individual would pay if they were getting their premium subsidized, ESI premium subsidized by the state rather than getting into the VHAP program. And it mirrors the amount of the premium amount they would pay if they were in the state program. And then next, under the Vermont level, Vermont section, you have the Catamount Health Assistance Program premiums. And for these, generally speaking, they're less expensive than the Minnesota Care premiums at these income levels. And one explanation for that may be that, that the Catamount program has deductibles and also a 20% coinsurance, and generally a less generous benefit set for at least clinical benefits, notwithstanding the $20,000 or $10,000 hospital cap in Minnesota Care. So that's what this spreadsheet shows. And then there's one final handout, which would not have been in your packet. It was one of the last things handed out. It's a spreadsheet entitled Premiums and Estimated Savings from Pre-Tax Accounts. It's one pager. Looks like this. And this was just supplied by the Department of Health, and I think it's based on some work done by House Research. But this shows in Minnesota what the affordability of premiums would be if somebody purchased a private policy in Minnesota using a Section 125 plan or a pre-tax plan. And this just shows, we'll just look at single parent, one child in the $21,700 income level. You can see the premium for that household would be $5,352. If they purchased it using a pre-tax plan, it would be $3,203. The savings, $2,149. That represents a 40% savings on that plan, but it does represent a 14.8% of their percent of income for that premium. And you can see, as you might expect, the percent of savings actually decreases or kind of goes down as the income levels go up, simply because there's more income available. There's less savings relative to the income, but the percent premium as a percent of income goes down dramatically as you go from 14.8% for that household size down to 4.6 for the same household size with a income of $70,000 a year. And that's all I have.
So the original information that Katie showed us did not incorporate into those premiums the tax benefits. This chart is trying to give examples of how that would affect those premiums.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I was looking at these, and I think I understand the math on the single no children. I get real confused on the math on the ones above it. Just let me throw out what I think is supposed to happen on a 125 plan. If you're in a 125 plan, payroll taxes are not paid on the wage, and then income taxes are not paid on that amount either.
On the amount of the premium.
On the amount of the premium.
Mm-hmm. That's what happens in employer plans today.
Yeah. No, I understand.
And this is trying to give that same advantage to an individual.
No, I understand. Let me just run through my difficulty with how the numbers as I'm seeing them. What that means is everybody saves their 8% or so on payroll taxes, FICA. It's the same for everybody.
Well, the employer would, yeah.
Yeah. But on income tax, the less you make, the lower your tax rate.
Right.
And for some people, especially under the federal tax, there is no break because your income is below the federal tax minimum. And so the gross dollar savings ought to increase as your income goes up because your tax rate goes up as you make more. And I see that on the single no children. I'm not seeing that on some of the other ones. And I guess I'm trying to understand why you're seeing people making less money having bigger tax breaks than people making more money.
Well, Ms. Sonia, who helped us, and we really appreciate your generous offer to do this for us since we were struggling trying to figure out how to do it ourselves. Why don't you come on up to the table and maybe you can answer the question. I don't know.
Thanks, Senator Berglund and Pete Benner. The source of this analysis actually was the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and they put this together for us back in January, February, when we were asking questions about how much would the governor's proposal for the health insurance exchange save people if they were able to pay their premiums on a pre-tax basis. And this is the analysis that backs up the statement that was made many times during legislative session that people would generally be saving 30% to 50% by paying pre-tax. The reason that the impact is so large at low-income levels is because there are very large interactions with other parts of the tax code. So particularly at the low-income levels, if you're able to protect another dollar of income from being income tax, your earned income tax credit would be larger. And that's my understanding of what happens. So it's actually a very elaborate analysis that the Revenue Department did, and that's only one of the interactions they took into consideration, but that would explain
the differences. And, of course, that would only be available to parents with children, not to single people without children. So,
got it. Got it. Thank you.
And, of course, this is not age-rated either. You have to just look and see how much the premium is, and, you know, this is an annual premium. So some of the categories that we've looked at in terms of the older folks without children, most of us don't have our children at home anymore when we get older, this premium would not be adequate for a policy that would cover very much. So we have to always keep that in mind, too. But we're trying to kind of pull these pieces as much as we can together to give people an idea. And I guess the way I look at it, for people who are in higher income categories, the advantage of a 125 benefit does help make their insurance more affordable. We don't have a lot of those people who are uninsured, but we have a few of them. So it might be a solution for that group. It might be a solution along with other things for lower income groups. But I don't think it's the total solution for lower income groups myself. But it might be a piece that you could put together with some other pieces maybe to get there. Are there questions? More questions about this sheet? Okay. Can we finish, David? Okay. Then we'll go back to Katie, and we'll look at this other problem that we are always reminded of in the legislature about people who are eligible for Medicaid only on a spend-down basis.
Okay, there in your packet there is eligibility on the basis of a spend-down, which is a one, and it gives some figures. And I was asked to just kind of give a basic 101 policy talk about what is a spend-down. And individuals who, except for the excess income, would qualify for coverage under one of the medical assistance categories can qualify for medical assistance through a spend-down. And under a spend down, an individual reduces his or her income by incurring medical bills in amounts that are equal to or greater than the amount by which their income exceeds the relevant spend down standard for the spend down period. And for families and children, the spend down standard is 100% of poverty, and for aged, blind, and disabled, it's 75%. And if you look at the federal poverty guidelines that we've put in your packet, you can tell what that monthly and annual figure is based on the family size. So the unpaid medical bills incurred before the time of application for medical assistance can be used to meet the spend down requirement. And there are two types of spend downs, 6 months or 1 month. Under a 6 month spend down, an individual can become eligible for medical assistance for up to 6 months beginning on the date his or her total 6 month spend down obligation is met. And under a 1 month spend down, individuals spend down their income during a month in order to become eligible for medical assistance for the remainder of that month. And we asked DHS to give us kind of a ballpark figure of what an average spend down is. And you can tell there the numbers that we received from DHS for the month of June. And it should be noted that the numbers here, not all the spend downs have been satisfied. And if we are going to just count the numbers of satisfied spend downs, then these numbers will obviously be different. That will give you an indication of kind of the average spend down that we look at.
So are there questions about this sheet? Most of the time, people that fall into the spend down categories are elderly and disabled, and most of the time they are one or two family households. Because most of the time, families who are on medical assistance are the only time a family on medical assistance is using spend down is when they have a catastrophic illness. So most of the time, families that are eligible for medical assistance, and they are eligible at higher income levels, are on the program more or less for a year to 6 months to a year. So when you look at the chart that shows income levels, you can look at the one and two families primarily to make a decision about what percentage of income people are spending. But and as Ms. Kavanagh said, people do not always meet the obligation. They've incurred the expense, but they haven't always met the obligation, which means if they're not meeting the obligation, then that amount ends up being bad debt to the provider that's serving them. Most of the time, if the obligation is needed to be met through medications in order to meet the spend down, the obligation is being met or the medications are not being provided. But in other cases where it's a procedure being done, a lab test or something like that, then the spend down may not be met, and then the obligation falls on the provider as uncompensated care. So any more questions on this sheet? It's a very difficult group of people to find affordable health care for. Yes.
The numbers that we have here, does this throw the 6 month and 1 month spend downs all together to get to these mean and medians?
So, yes.
Yes.
Is there any big difference between the amounts we're talking about?
I don't believe so.
Madam Chair, I'm not quite sure. I don't think so. But and that's something we can ask DHS.
We created the 1 month spend down to help people who otherwise we're not going to be able to meet the 6 month spend down, and who clearly needed to have access to the medical assistance program.
The numbers just look very small for a 1 month.
Well, they're not small in relationship to the income of the individuals that we're talking about. You know, what happens with the medical debt, you know, let's just say it's an emergency. It's a family and they didn't have insurance and the child is got a very serious illness, you know, in the thousands of dollars of cost. What happens is the family ends up being responsible for the first dollar amount to meet the spend down, and Medicaid pays the rest. So that would account for some of the numbers not being as large. Other questions? Okay. All right, well then, we thought it might be good after having these materials presented to us to have some more discussion about individual affordability. And at least based on the conversation that the group had last time, we are assuming that when we talk about this, most of you are wanting to talk about premiums, deductibles, and out-of-pocket costs, and not just premiums. And I wanted to just say that in regard to the discussion that we had last time, in regard to value purchasing or value benefit sets, we have asked one of the cost containment working groups to look at that issue. And so all the other cost containment work groups will be reporting into us. They're not at the stage where they're ready to do that yet, but they will be reporting into us, and we will be then looking at their most promising ideas and trying to figure out what to do with them in terms of translating them into some part of what we're going to do or some part of the savings that we might be able to generate. So what do you think?
I'll start. How about that? In thinking about, there's one other piece that you have in here, which is it's a document that looks like this, and it really is just a start of a way to put on paper trying to think through this, and it's more meant as kind of a template to have some discussion around what we want our ultimate end product to look up with, and there's a lot, there's many more dimensions, I think, that need to go into the final document we start with. But this was just to kind of get the idea of this was just to start getting discussion going, and especially in light of a lot of the information presented today on where other states are and what might be reasonable. That was kind of the intent here about, you know, what coming up with what we might think is affordable. And I guess the other thing that I would raises maybe a question we should discuss that came up in the discussion here is, you know, Massachusetts appears to have used their affordability discussion as kind of who qualifies for the mandate or not, as opposed to using it for guidance in some other way. And maybe we need to have a discussion about what we're going to use affordability standards for as well. I don't know if that's because I never really thought about that issue until you raised that. And I don't even know if there's a difference there, but
I think it'd be fair to say that they're using it in two ways. One, they're trying to get as many people into their affordability schedule as they can.
Yeah.
And they have recognized that at least in the beginning they may not get everybody into that affordability schedule, so they've given people an exemption then from the mandate. I don't think it's designed, or I don't think their goal was to have a lot of people in that category that would be eligible for the exemption, but they recognize they may not in the beginning have everybody in their affordability category.
So I guess what this document is just a start to see, to think out what are we going to present to the Whole Health Care Access Commission, and, you know, kind of what will that look like and what needs to be added and subtract, and, you know, that's kind of where this is. So that's what that is. So I guess that would be how I would leave it at this point. And
yes.
Madam Chair, I was struck in the readings that we had how consistent the message is about the value of progressive schedules. So that makes sense to see here. But I wondered about the 9.6 number. I was getting a sense as up to the 300% of the federal poverty level in looking at what was considered affordable and trying to be conservative in that assumption because maybe the numbers aren't as good as they were when they were first established as a guide, that something closer to 7 or 8% was coming out of some of the materials as a more reasonable expectation of people at this level of income. And I just wondered.
So are you saying that what you'd like to see us do, what we did do was try not to change the existing schedule, and that's how we got to the 9.6. Assuming that we might have to go to a higher income level of subsidizing people if we would mandate coverage. You're saying you'd like to see us adjust the whole schedule downward, which is what we would have to do in order to end up at 8%.
I think I'm more asking a question than making a suggestion, but in my sense of uptake and elasticity and affordability, the sense I was getting from our readings and from some other information was that 7 or 8% seemed to be the level at which people stopped participating. And if 9.6% is a barrier, is it yet another aspect of the problem? And do we need to think about adjusting down at the same time as we're adjusting income levels?
Okay. Other discussion? Yes.
From the readings from the Kaiser Commission that he did recommend, the number I was struck by was, I think they said that it was 5%. Was where you started. If you wanted to have everybody in so it was affordable, it was about 5. And as you got above 5, you started to have elements that just still yet couldn't afford it. So, you know, ultimately we have to find where we can afford to be collectively, and like Massachusetts probably won't have everybody affording it. But I think even by their numbers, 7 or 8 might be kind of high for the group we're really talking about, the most vulnerable of the population.
The interesting thing when you look at the groups of people that are uninsured in Minnesota and who are eligible for coverage, which would include those who are eligible for Minnesota Care, the number of people that are uninsured and eligible for our programs are much larger in the Medicaid program where there is no premium than the number who are uninsured and eligible for Minnesota Care. So it isn't always price that keeps people from having coverage, I think is the conclusion you would draw from that. We might be too high on our schedule, and I think, you know, we could look at doing some schedules that end at a lower level and see you know, how much does that increase the subsidies we have to provide? It wouldn't be huge amounts, I don't think, but it would be something that we would have to assume then in terms of cost, and we could get that information and look at the trade-off about it. Yes.
I think sort of in response to Representative Thiessen's question is, and maybe I'm not thinking about this the right way, but when I was thinking about the whole issue about affordability, I was sort of assuming that we were talking about the overall population, not simply people within the state programs. And I think one reason to that we might want to think about that is that, I mean, part of the, frankly, I think part of the difficulty politically of doing sort of major health care reform is that, particularly in Minnesota, is we've got 93% who have got insurance, are basically happy with it, but are worried about how long they're going to keep it and prices are going to be going up and all the rest of it. And I think that if the commission was to establish an affordability standard, that we could then measure not just what's going on within the state programs, but the other 93% that are out there and come up with a figure that we're really not talking about just 7% that are uninsured, but we're talking more like 35 to 40% who are faced with unaffordable health insurance. I mean, they're paying for it. I mean, because I think there's a difference between unaffordable that you can't pay and unaffordable that somehow you manage to pay. That the political discussion becomes very different if you've got a number of 35% who really are functioning with unaffordable health insurance or are sort of more underinsured. It's a much different conversation, you know, in terms of what the solutions might be and the rest of it. So I guess I was sort of hoping that we'd be able to expand the discussion, not just thinking about, you know, the state programs, but really thinking about everybody else in terms of what, particularly for, you know, looking at universal coverage and potentially a mandate and the rest of those kind of things. I think it's an important issue that we have to get a handle on is what really is an affordable amount that we expect in Minnesota for people to be able to pay for health insurance, sort of regardless of where they get their health insurance.
I think we are talking about a broader discussion. I think Representative Thiessen indicated this was a starting point. But that's why we provided you materials from these other states about what is happening with affordability through their connectors and what they have decided is an affordability standard. And we've tried to look at, you know, the group that I think is probably the hardest to get coverage affordable for on an individual basis, and that is the older group, to see if they manage to make it or not for them. And so that at least we can be aware, you know, if we need to do something different than them, where we might need to look. But I think, you know, and that's why we've included in here, although not very many places have done it, Vermont does subsidize people who have employer insurance available to them, but where it may not be affordable to them. And that's partly getting at the question that you are raising. There are other ways of doing it. Washington State just started a voluntary connector, and they decided that they would offer a subsidy for the insurance policy that would be purchased for those who are at or below 200% of poverty, so that in addition to the tax credit and the structuring of the policies, they also would subsidize people to buy into the private market through their connector.
And Senator Berlin, and just to, this was intended both not just to be public programs either, it was to give guidance more broadly for in some of the ways that, but I think I would echo Senator Berglund's comments. I don't think that we're looking only at public programs. This is just to, my sense of this is to set some guidelines across the board.
Other comments? Yes.
I have, thank you. One comment that I don't think I've seen addressed in any of the materials from the other states is whether they had a discussion at all of consideration of assets. and also whether there was a consideration of what are the other, you know, kind of necessity expenses and what do they cost and kind of what's left. Because there's one way to say, you know, that's one way to get at what a maximum affordability amount is, to say what's the minimum you need to have on, you know, cost of rent and heat and food or transportation. I'm not sure what the other ones are, but, you know, I haven't seen either of those addressed in the other materials we've seen.
Well, we did have a presentation at one of our meetings by folks from Minnesota talking about a household income and what's affordable. We had materials that we handed out from both California and Massachusetts in regard to some of their discussions of affordability.
I can go back and look at them again.
Yeah.
But it feels like both asset position and those other items need to be part of our discussion. We can't look at the affordability of health without those pieces. And for Minnesota, some of those might be very different than, say, California or...
We realize that. We just don't have a lot of places to look. There are other states having the discussion now, but there are not very many that are before us. We could see if NCSL has any ideas of any materials like that that might be available through other states that are discussing the issue now. In terms of assets, there is an asset test in the Medicaid program.
Right.
But we do not have, well, we have an asset test in Minnesota Care, but it's a fairly generous asset test because the program was designed for working people. And we didn't want people to not be able to be getting retirement savings. We didn't want people to not be able to have vehicles to get to their work. We didn't want people to not have any incentive to save money. And we can get those for you, what they are in the Minnesota Care program. But generally speaking, my impression is that they have not been a huge barrier to people coming into the program. We have also got a... In our Medicaid program, we have a program for disabled individuals to encourage them to work. It's called the Employed Persons with Disabilities Program. And you have to be declared disabled by the federal government and be eligible for Medicare. But you also can be eligible for the Medicaid benefits if you are working and earning at least $60 a month. And if you're in that program, then the asset limit is much higher. I mean, it's higher than I even have. I mean, you know, the idea again is, you know, if you're working, you should be able to have some assets and you should be looking towards some savings for retirement. And we can get maybe some materials about those, both Minnesota Care, the assets, and the Employed Persons with Disabilities Program assets. One of the reasons that we don't have a lot of asset tests in Minnesota Care is, again, because it makes it more difficult. The application process becomes more cumbersome. The cost of enrolling a person becomes greater for the state.
Sure.
And all of that. So that's one of the reasons we haven't been as restrictive on assets. But we'll get that information for you. Other discussion? Yes.
So, Madam Chair, a couple points. Just on the asset issue, my wife and I had the misfortune of having to fill out the 40 pages
yes.
on behalf of her mother. And, you know, and we're, I think, reasonably well-educated, sophisticated folks, and we were having problems understanding it. And, you know, figuring out affordability simply based upon premium is a challenge. I think we have at least some level of agreement here. We also have to be taking into account out-of-pockets. the test at the end of the day has to be one that can be administered in the real world in real time, where the application process does not itself become what is the real deterrent for people applying. The Kaiser study on Medicaid and the uninsured was suggesting, in addition to the financial barrier, the next single biggest barrier are just the hoops we put in front of people getting into the programs in the first place and having filled out 40 pages of hoops. We were at a point where we were told by the county financial worker that if anything changed in grandma's financial situation, please don't tell them, because if the thing is not current within X amount of time, we would have to refile the whole damn thing, and she would have to reprocess the whole damn thing for, you know, that amount of change in, you know, an asset or an income. What I really wanted to get into, I think, was the broader discussion on affordability. I put together for the group just a couple handouts, one of which I thought I had saved, and I guess I didn't, with some title changes, on just some comparative information on what premiums cost in the real world and how that compares to what people make in the real world. And I use state employee group premiums just because that's where I'm out of and I know what those are over time, and then took two sets of information. One, and it's an untitled document, I'm sorry, this starts, looks like this, and this just takes the average hourly wage for the folks that AFSCME represented over a 27-year period, took the, I think this actually happened to be the group health partners premium over this time frame. So it was one plan. And then how many hours of work equivalent did it take for an average worker, you know, what's that premium cost? And if you go back to 1980, it cost basically 5 hours of work or the equivalent for to cover single coverage, 14 and a half hours for family coverage. With all the wage increases we've had since, we're now, despite that, we're at 22 and a half hours of work for single coverage. We're at 66 and a half hours of work for family coverage. And if you look just over the last 10 years or so, it has doubled. You know, and the question I asked me, you know, why is affordability an issue now in a way it really wasn't back in 92, 93, 94? And you just look at the comparative data here and the absolute rise in the cost of health care and the not horribly great rise in earnings for real workers. The pressure that puts both on employers to come up with the money, and as the share, the worker share, the premium goes up, you know, every year, it becomes more of a challenge.
Well, and this is only premiums. It's not any
not
of the deductibles are out
That's
of pockets.
That's right. And if you look at plan design over this period, especially in the last years, the out-of-pockets have gone up. I said, well, this was just state employees. What about Minnesotans in general? And the job service, whatever they call themselves now, uses unemployment data to come up with something called the average weekly wage. And it's reasonably accurate data for at least anyone that reports on their unemployment numbers. And I just took, again, for the same 20, in this case, 26-year period, since there's not 07 data yet on unemployment numbers, what was the average weekly wage, multiplied it by 52, divided it by 12, so I got an average monthly wage, and used that state employee premium, again, just as a surrogate for premiums in the broader market. And that says that single premium in 80 was about 3% of that average monthly wage. That family premium was 9.5%. Today, it's 10.5% for the single. It's 31% for the family. And to me, that just kind of encapsulates why unions and their employers are banging their heads on who's paying what on insurance and why we're doing the things we're doing on the out-of-pockets. And And that the affordability issue, I think, as Holly's saying, goes well beyond what we look at in public programs. It goes, you know, I mean, $35,000 or $3,500 a month, which is the average monthly wage for Minnesotans on whom unemployment insurance is collected, is not a lot of money. And you know, you look at the I thank whoever put this in our packet, the federal poverty guidelines, and you just kind of track $3,500 a month across the chart here, and for a family of for families of large enough size, that's not even getting to 200% of poverty. And even for families of somewhat small size, that still is under 300% of poverty. So you know, as we talk about 300% of poverty as a standard here, that we might want to be dealing with affordability on, you're talking about most Minnesotans average weekly wage or less.
Senator Berglund? I just had a question for Pete. The amounts for the premium payments, those are just the employee share,
no,
right?
No, this is just the gross amount of the premiums.
Okay, gross amount.
That doesn't deal with who pays what share.
Okay.
Well, there is no doubt that we have to do something to control the costs of health care. We have working groups that are supposedly working on that, and Tom and I are going to be checking in with them tomorrow to see how they're doing. But we were given several tasks, one of which was to look at what would we consider affordable if we were going to require people to have health care coverage. Or even if we weren't, if we were going to try and get more people insured in Minnesota than we have today and stop our slide in the wrong direction here, what would we need to do to get more people covered? And of course, one aspect of that is how much should it cost them? And so I'm going to try and pull us back to that task a little bit here.
I support Don's comment on I think we're starting too high on these numbers. I mean, as we work this in more detail, as we try to take cognizance at the higher income levels on, you know, what's possible there, what's happening, you know, we may find ourselves moving that progressive scale up. But just, you know, watching this process over enough years and in bargaining, you know, if you start it at 9.6, we know what direction it's going to go. It's not going to go down. The process works it up. And I think all our tendencies to make numbers fit within the available budgets that are around there says that the political pressure will be to make the number go up. And I think as we're trying to work through, you know, what we ought to be bringing into that debate, we need to understand that our job is going to be holding on to whatever number we come up with, as it is shot at from all sorts of different directions, for some reasons valid and some reasons, at least I would suggest, are not valid.
Other comments? So is that Representative Teason?
Let me just kind of thinking process-wise here, and I think this is, you know, one thing I'm hearing is that some of this needs to maybe move down. I think ultimately, Pete, you're making a good point that we need to come up with something that's not just a chart like this, but something that then compares it to, you know, the Jobs Now data that looks at household budgets and compares to where other states are, you know, so we have a justification for the numbers. But before we can, I think just even for staff purposes, before we can do that, we actually need to at least have some basic numbers that we can then do those comparisons against. And one of the things, at least I'm hearing, is that, you know, and I don't, this doesn't necessarily have to be the format we do it in, but that at least up to 300% of poverty, we're looking at a number that's lower than the 9.6% to start these comparisons, and maybe, you know, someone said 5, 7, and 8, maybe 7% is something that we could look at, or 8, you know, is it worth having a discussion, at least as a preliminary matter, to say, well, couple things. First of all, are people, you know, Medicaid right now, I'm assuming that we want to just keep the current Medicaid level so we have no premiums, no, I mean, basically no money for people that currently qualify for Medicaid in Minnesota? Is that...
There are some small co-payments that they make for...
Well, we should have that discussion, yeah. But which don't really do much of anything except discourage people from getting health care, but that's maybe an editorial comment. But, I mean, is that... Are people comfortable with that? And we also, in that discussion, have to have the discussion about adults without kids who are state-only, largely, dollars as opposed to a federal match on some of those. But maybe that's one place we can start, is to say we want to keep at least our current programs that are related to Medicaid or GAMC, maybe expand them a little bit, but that there shouldn't be any or very limited dollars going out for those folks. I mean, is that kind of where everybody is?
Sure.
Okay. I mean, okay.
Okay.
And then it sounds like we want to compress the Minnesota Care premium schedule a little bit to bring it down to some endpoint. What, I mean, do people have a sense of an endpoint? That's another question I guess I would put out there. And then we have to have the discussion over 300% of poverty, perhaps. But that's kind of where my observations at least are at this point.
Yes.
The article that Representative Thiessen sent out, I don't know if people had a chance to read it, but they did an analysis of, for Massachusetts primarily, so the numbers are going to be a little different just because healthcare costs are more expensive in Massachusetts, and I think housing maybe and the rest of it. But they looked at all the available research that has been done on this question of affordability, and there are a lot of different ways you can slice it, but they basically came up with recommendations that for 300% of poverty and under, that people really don't have, I mean, that people really don't have money to put out for health care is fundamentally what their findings were.
Well, they need to have some subsidy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's but not that they don't have anything to put toward their health care.
Well, I think if I remember, actually, let me just, I may be misstating it, but so 300% or under, and then I think they top the top range at for 600% and over at 8.5% of income, and then did a sliding thing between 4% and 8.5% for the 300 to 600%, I think is where they were looking. So then that seemed substantial. I mean, that was sort of the first thing that I had seen that really said, you know, for income levels that most people would think you would have enough money to be able to, you know, deal with health care, you really can't. I think that what one thing that speaks is that certainly in terms of the Minnesota Care piece that the issue of whether we can afford it or not is a whole other issue, but in terms of just sort of the principle of it, would certainly, you know, based on other people's comments as well, need to be ratcheted down some. But I think even for, you know, the 300 to 600%, that at least this recommendation was between 4 and 8.5% for premiums and out of pockets. Now, that again was based on stuff from Massachusetts, but that might, you know, clearly be the low end of the affordability stuff, or the most conservative end of the affordability stuff. But I think that it's an important benchmark for us at least to think about, and if we need to deviate from that, you know, have some rationale for why in Minnesota we can expect people to pay more than that, I guess, would be one thought anyway.
Well, the other thing that Massachusetts did was they looked at how much people were paying for employer-sponsored coverage, and they did not want to erode that market by setting their threshold too low so that, you know, they were creating products that were causing people to leave
right. The
market that they already had.
Right. I mean, I guess, and I don't know, I may be repeating myself, so I apologize for that. But, I mean, it would be good if we could sort of think about in the, you know, the best possible worlds where, you know, all money was available and all things could be done, what would be the right affordability level, and then understanding that all things are not what they could be, that then have sort of the pragmatism of, okay, well, you know, they're simply, until we get the costs under control and really ratchet down the spending, we're not going to be able to get there. But, I mean, I guess I'd like to see us at least have the conversation around what really would be the best of all possible worlds, and then understanding that to get there, it's going to get stepped in, and it will be based on the, you know, the pragmatism of how much money there really is and all the rest of it. But sort of to Pete's point of if we sort of account for that on the front end of the conversation, then once we get into the political process, it'll only get worse. We're going to get further and further away from what really is affordable versus what we can actually afford to make affordable.
Other comments?
Senator Berger, I go back to a comment Donna made last week, and I'm with you, Holly. But I'm also thinking about the I'm so glad to see the next meeting is on benefit sets, and what is it you're buying, and what is it we're actually getting? Because of my role at the hospital, I think about, I'd love to see more hospital coverage occur under Minnesota Care. Don't get me wrong. I think
we did propose it this year.
Yeah, I know.
And last year.
I know. We'll keep trying.
Was one of the things that got crossed off the list in the negotiation process.
There's always next year. So I just lay that out there as a, you kind of have to know a little bit of what you're buying as to how much you're going to spend. And I'm obviously that's a part of our next meeting. So to put that in the mix of what we're thinking about here.
Well, and I can just tell you also that one of our working groups that's looking at cost containment is going to be looking at evidence-based benefit sets, as was suggested at our last meeting when we had testimony from the Physician and Health Partners. I can tell you that nobody's actually done one. You know, the closest thing we have to look at is the Oregon list again. And there is not evidence for every procedure to know whether it's evidence-based or not. So you can only look at procedures that have some evidence. But we do think that that's worthy to look at, and they are working on that. So we need to keep that in the back of our minds also. Other comments? Yes.
I'm sitting here trying to reconcile the paper out of Massachusetts and the Kaiser Foundation paper in amounts, and forgetting about benefit sets and trying to stick with the question of what can people afford to pay. I'd like to throw out the idea that of people's gross income, we think about capping the 300% at 5%, and then indexing it up to 8.5% as you go to 600%, and I think that's consistent with where those two papers were. And how could we model that? Could we model that out and see where that got us?
Well, I think maybe what we'll do is we'll do a couple of scenarios. We'll do one at 5%, at 300% of poverty. We'll do one at 6, one at 7, and one at 8. And we'll see what that would look like and how much that would cost.
I think that's an important comment because, you know, one of the things we're going to have are some definitions. Is when we're talking income, Kaiser was using net out of pocket, and so if we're talking gross income, some of these are versus the net and out of pocket, it's really a different number.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, if you look at some of the numbers we talked about before, they're a lot closer when you consider what the source of the data was they used to
mm-hmm.
make that recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I don't know how this fits in, but one of the issues that I see a lot is that people who started a year in one category for whatever reason or other, one of the earners in the family gets sick and is not earning, loses job, whatever, you can very quickly bounce back and forth between these various categories.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, as we walked in today, we had some comments about some things that happened almost automatically with the disasters and the floods and everything, that all of a sudden some of the restrictions on pharmacy benefits and time to next prescription, things like that, went away. It seems we almost need some flexibility mechanisms to handle the emergencies that affect affordability. I don't think we're very nimble, but it seems that if we get the definitions that we feel comfortable with, it shouldn't be all that hard to then build in some flexibility that automatically perhaps starts giving premium holidays to people as their family situation changes and then moves them back. Because we see a lot of people who I think just drop out completely when something like that happens. Second earner goes down, and all of a sudden they just drop their insurance completely.
We do in Minnesota Care give people the opportunity to report changes of income so that they can have their premium adjusted during the middle of their eligibility period.
Yeah, it's kind of the timeliness of something like that. I have a daughter who just started in the workforce, and I was kind of struck by the fact that she started working for a health insurance company here in town and left her insurance with her other employer, that she was left with about a 7-week period where she didn't have any health insurance.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is the next thing after everything else that we're doing, is to look at ways we can make sure people have continuous coverage. That's another whole nother topic.
Because that uninsured data we talk about really balloons when we talk about people who are uninsured for any part mm-hmm. of the period of time. And since we have a hard time predicting just when these disasters in our lives occur, I think that's as important an issue as exactly what the affordability is or what are the mechanisms that we assure that people will still have access to the right access to care.
Yes.
Madam Chairman, and every couple of years I ask the House Research to prepare this little chart for me that has median family incomes, the various quintiles, I don't know. I'll have them do that again. But my guess is right now the median family income for a family of four in Minnesota is around $70,000, which is probably 350% of poverty. So if you're going to have a subsidy for that family at 350% of poverty, you're going to have a subsidy for half the people in the state of Minnesota. The magnitude that we're talking about.
Well, universal single payer is 100%.
Wouldn't it be important for us to think about also trying to model in this where the employer contribution part of it? I know when we looked at this in our own work that it, without taking that into account, it was pretty hard to tell whether the rest of it was affordable as well. So we were trying to look at what's the employer part of the equation, because if you think about without the employer participation and you're up in the 20 plus range, that's not affordable by any standards. So in some ways it sort of screams for the importance of the employers to stay in the market and modeling it also with some idea of what the average participation is on part of employers for some of these higher income groups that we're talking about. We may be able to pull up some of that that we put together, as well as the out-of-pocket costs, which vary a lot, you know, based on use as well.
Yes. We have started looking at individuals who don't have employer coverage, mm-hmm. who need to either be purchasing individual insurance in the private market or be getting a subsidized product through the state, because they seem like they're the hardest
right.
ones to get affordability for. There is the issue of employers also, and, we define employer coverage for the purposes of Minnesota Care as an employer who pays at least 50% of a premium.
Right.
But we do know that at some income levels, 50% of a premium is going to be an awful lot of a family's income. And that's why we've introduced some of the ideas about, at some level, perhaps subsidizing employer-sponsored insurance for the employee. Yes.
Madam Chair, and just in follow-up to Representative Huntley's comments about median data, I know the Revenue Department produces annually a just tax information where it does, I think in, is decile the right word? It goes taxes paid by tenths. And so you have a sense of the bottom 10% of filers pay had income of X, the next 10% had income of Y, and so forth. And I think it gives you a good sense of, you know, at least in terms of a definition of income that reported by the Revenue Department, where people in Minnesota are in terms of their family income stuff. I don't know how well they can slice and dice that by family size or other demographics, but I know it's a nice visual of getting, you know, some sense of how big this pie is we may be biting into.
Well, we'll see what we can get on that. Our staff has that type of information available. Are there other things that you'd like to see us work on to get for you all for the next meeting? Yes.
Following up on Representative Huntley's comment and then the earlier comment on what we're looking at in terms of housing, transportation, et cetera, I know we've touched upon this in earlier meetings, and I think that California example provided more insight. But in looking at Massachusetts, I don't see a breakdown in terms of geographic area. And if you're looking at, you know, a family of four at $70,000, that's 50% of the state. When you look at percentage of income, the dollar amount's the same for health care. But then if you look at what percentage of your income are you paying for, say, housing, because making $70,000, the type of house you can afford in the Twin Cities, perhaps, versus some other area, there's going to be a huge difference. So as we're building the scale, are we going to take in the geographic discrepancies in terms of the other household, you know, payments into that?
We can see what the staff can provide us on median income based on region of the state. Other information people would like?
Can I just raise one other? Thank you, Senator. The other question on this out-of-pocket issue, one question that do we, like, particularly for deductibles, I guess, are we talking about assuming someone's going to pay out the entire deductible each year when we're talking about affordability? Because, you know, presumably most people don't. If you get a $5,000 deductible policy, most people aren't going to pay $5,000. Maybe I'm not right about that, but I'm guessing that that's the case. I mean, I'd be interested to see kind of people's just reactions, or maybe that's something to think about for the next time around. But when we're talking about kind of what we're really talking about in terms of what people are spending, are we going to assume everybody's going to spend down their deductible, or are we going to just, are we going to, do we need to gather other information about what happens on average?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I think that's a key question that begins to relate the discussion to health. There's an interesting phenomenon occurring in the commercial world. So we can get data on how much of the high deductibles people end up spending, but the more interesting data that's starting to accumulate is, for instance, somebody with comprehensive, if we take a group of people with comprehensive coverage, small or no deductibles, there's 20 to 30% of those people who don't routinely seek appropriate and evidence-based care. At the point where deductibles go to $1,000 or $2,000, those numbers go from 20 to 30% to 35 and 45% respectively for $1,000 and $2,000 deductibles. It's a newer phenomenon that we didn't see with copays, with fixed dollar copays. So the one statistic would be how much do they spend, but some of them aren't spending because they're not getting necessary care.
Well, just is that something you guys can pull together? Then?
Yep.
I think that would help.
Well, and again, we need to remember that commercial plans insure the healthy people. So whatever we could get from them, we need to remember there's this AMSHA group of people too. And
Madam Chair,
the idea of having universal coverage in my own mind is to eliminate uncompensated care and to make sure people are getting the proper care when they need it. So to say, well, we're going to take the group of people that's sick and we're going to leave them out of the equation based on, you know, what they would spend of a deductible, I think is not appropriate. Yes.
Madam Chair, I know I've got data for the state employee group just on how many people in a year hit the out-of-pocket max. And I would expect the plans, at least for their employed business, could give
you
some estimates on for typical policies of X.
That would give us a better idea. A better idea because, you know, there's no underwriting in the group market, very little anyway. Yeah, why don't you do that? Other comments? Okay, well, we've got assignments to work on before we see you again. And to the extent it's possible, we'll try and get it out to you ahead of time if we can. And if you can please leave these little charts about how much income people has based on their percentage of poverty in your folder, then you'll have it when you come back and we won't have to keep reproducing it because we probably will be referring to it fairly often. And thank you, everyone, for your attendance and the good work that we've done so far. We are making progress, I think. So that's good. And with that, the meeting will be adjourned.